About time to start. I may be short a little bit like Tim was on Wednesday as well, but we'll go ahead and begin. And today we'll be studying multiple verses. You can see up there, kind of chopped up a little bit. But the topic is the dedication of the temple by Solomon. So as a quick review, remember on Wednesday what we did is we discussed the preparations of the temple, and then its construction and how the people were organized, the number of people it took. If you remember, there were like 30,000 men that were in 10,000 men rotations to go get just the timber that was cut from the forest of Lebanon and then brought down and taken over to the grounds where the temple was being built. So we discussed that. We discussed, you know, all of the ornate fixtures, the cherubim that were in the holy place, and the gold overlaid with all the intricate carvings, etc. So there was a lot of details that we went over. And then remember, this is the layout of the temple itself. We talked about the length, the width, and the storerooms that were around the outside. And so here's kind of a depiction of that. A lot of material went into that, but today we're going to see that that it is completed, and we can begin in 1 Kings the 6th chapter, and specifically 37 and 38, the last two verses there. In the fourth year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid in the month of Ziv. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So it was 7 years in building it. So it took them 7 years to complete the entire build. Now the month of Ziv would have been, I think, the second month in the Hebrew calendar. And then, a lot of the story that we have today is actually during the 7th month, and after the dedication is completed, they were almost to the end of the 7th month. Thus the reference here to the month of Bul, which is the 8th month. So, there were, one of the first things that was done is, if we remember, several weeks ago we talked about David had collected all of this material, right? And he collected a massive amount of gold and silver, and then it says bronze. They didn't, is that me? It's only when I talk. A massive amount of bronze that was beyond counting. So I'll stand really still. Is it on now? Okay. That's gonna be hard for me. So a lot of that material that was beyond number even, it was too much to even weigh, so they just always had that on hand. And now, that the temple is completed, there were still some additional things there, right? There were still additional gold and silver. And so that material was then placed as one of the first acts into the treasury. And we see that the elders of Israel were assembled. Now that occurs in 1 Kings the 8th chapter. In the 7th chapter, in the 51st verse, we see that thus all the work that King Solomon performed in the house of the Lord was finished, and Solomon brought in the things dedicated by his father, the silver and the gold and the utensils, and he put them in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. Then 8, verse 1. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel, to King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant with the Lord from the city of David. To bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from the city of David, which is Zion. So now we are in the 7th month that tells us this. And now all the men of Israel are being gathered together here. Verse 2, it tells us it's in the seventh month. So they came for the sole purpose at this point of putting all of the items back in, you know, to the temple. They also brought up the articles from the tent of meeting. So we see that in verse 5 that the sacrifice of sheep and oxen were so many that they could not be counted or numbered. And then all of the items from the tent of meeting were brought back up. And specifically, we find that all of the Levites were present. Now, do you remember a couple of weeks ago, and actually, right before David's death, how things were organized, and all of the Levites were divided, you know, into sets of 12. And why was that? I mean, into 12 different groups. Why was that? So that they could, what's that? Well, all the people were divided into those 12 like districts so that they could divide the work that was required to provide for the king on a monthly basis, right? But we also saw that the Levites specifically were divided there as well, right, for the care of the temple, which had yet to be built, right? The care of the temple, the guarding of the temple, and then the singers and whatnot, right? They had another group that did all that. Because what was the role of the Levites before the temple was built? There's like three different sections, right? Three different major groups. One were to be the priests, right? Another one was to be the ones that moved all the articles, right? And the third one was, help me with this one, because I just lost it. Yeah. Physical, for all the articles, that's correct. One was for the big tent itself and all the walls and the coverings and whatnot. The other group was just specifically for moving all the articles within it. So now that the structure is going to be permanent, right? Do two of those groups really have anything to do? No, right? They're not going to be moving the temple around. So they are reassigned different tasks. And accordingly, they would be coming in and kind of month-long shifts. But at this point, we see that all of the Levites are actually there for the dedication. And it goes into several of the numbers of the Levites that were there. It says that the Levite singers and 120 priests who had musical instruments as they sang praises to God. This was all occurring as they took the ark into the holy place. In, 2 Chronicles, I think it has a little bit better, description when I read the differences between the two. In 2 Chronicles, beginning in chapter 5, verse 1, and moves all the way through 7, verse 10, we'll kind of stay there because a lot of that's duplicated from 1 Kings, most of chapter 8. But here they are about to bring the ark in. So they have everything completed. And the last piece that's going to go into the temple here is the ark. So they go in, they set the ark in place. And then what occurs when they do that? What do we see that occurs? It's happened before with the tabernacle. What occurs this time as well? The place was filled with, right, the glory of the Lord, and it specifically talks about, you know, this from something that we could see externally, this big, thick cloud, right? So, the ark is set in place, then a cloud descends on the temple, and it's so thick that the Levite priests can't do anything. They can't hardly see to move around, so they back out. And when this occurs, we see Solomon's statement. First of all, in 1 Kings chapter 8, 10, 11, it tells us that the cloud filled the house. It also tells us that in 2 Chronicles chapter 5, when we see verses 11 through 14. But in Exodus, the 40th chapter, we see this the first time. In Exodus chapter 40, verse 34 and 35, it says, "Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple." So, if we remember, God accepted the temple as it was built, and or the tent of meeting as it was built. And what was one of the things that I think, I know that I've, reiterated to the children when I've taught that section, but what was one key thing that we can take away to say that the tent of meeting was built according to what? That's right. According to the pattern that God gave, right? And so God was accepting of that because this pattern was fulfilled. So here we see a similar act, right, where the temple, even though we don't have a lot of the details of that, we do remember that right before David passes, it says that he instructed Solomon in all the things that he was to do. So God had given them a pattern. Now apparently, even though we don't have all the details of that pattern was fulfilled, right? That pattern was followed, and it was done according to the will of God. And so God is showing externally to individuals that, yes, this is done and this is where I will dwell. Now I think one of the questions in the lesson is, does God physically dwell in the temple? Is that what's happening here? No. Right. In 2 Chronicles 6:18, as Doug said, and 1 Kings 8:27, is that right? 2 Chronicles 6:18 says, "But will God indeed dwell with mankind on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this house which I have built." It's during Solomon's prayer. But we see that this is a representation of a place where God will be on this earth, but it is not the intent that God would dwell inside of this or could be contained by this single building. So I think an important point here. So once the glory of the Lord filled the temple in 2 Chronicles 5 verse 14, it says, "So that the priest could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. Then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in the thick cloud. I have built you a lofty house and a place for your dwelling forever." Okay. Then he turns around and he faces the crowd and he begins to talk to all those who are assembled, right? So he has fulfilled his promises, is what he begins to talk about in the next few verses, all the way to verse 11. And Solomon talks about that, the Lord God spoke to Israel and specifically to David, and that today this is being fulfilled. He talks about the fact that David wanted to build this house, but David was not allowed to. Remember why? It says it here. Right? But he has the blood on his hands, right, from the wars. And so he's not allowed to, but it says in verse 9, "Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who will be born to you, he shall build the house for my name. And now the Lord has fulfilled his word which he spoke. For I have risen in the place of my father David and sit on the throne of Israel as the Lord promised, and have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. There I have set the ark, which is in the covenant of the Lord, which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with the sons of Israel. So he completes this. He explains to all the people what God has done and how he has fulfilled his promises. At this point, too, we see it, here it is in verse 13. He is standing on a specific platform that was made of bronze so that he could get up high and people could see him, the crowds of people that were around. And so in the next verse, after he explains to them that God has actually fulfilled all of his promises, he turns and he prays to God. And it's quite a beautiful prayer that's very, the theme is repetitive, right? And we'll see, I'm going to go through a couple of them real quick, but you can see the pattern that he lays out, and then knowing what happens throughout the rest of the kings and Israel, we see that cyclical pattern as well, right? As long as they follow God, then he will forgive them, but then they fall into sin, and then it comes back around and they're punished in some way. Then if they look back to God, he forgives them and they go again. So we see that pattern in the real history of the Israelites. But here in this prayer, we see Solomon speaking. It begins in verse 14. O Lord, the God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven or on earth, keeping covenant and showing loving kindness to your servants who walk before you with all their heart, who have kept with your servant David, my father, that which you have promised him. Indeed, you have spoken with your mouth and have fulfilled it with your hand to this day. And through 17, he continues to talk in his prayer to God about these promises that were kept. And then in verse 18, but will God indeed dwell with mankind on earth? Behold, the heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less than this house which I have built, which we just read, talking about whether it could contain God or not. Yet have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his supplication, O Lord my God, to listen to the cry and to the prayer which your servant prays before you. So he's asking God to be able to listen to those and to listen to him specifically at this point. Listen to those supplications from his servants, those who follow him. Verse 22, we see, if a man sins against his neighbor and is made to take an oath, and he comes and takes an oath before your altar in this house, then hear from heaven and act and judge your servants, punishing the wicked by bringing his way on his own head, and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness. Verse 24, if your people Israel are defeated before an enemy because they have sinned against you, and they return to you and confess your name and pray and make supplications before you, then hear from heaven. Okay? Verse 26, when the heavens are shut up and there is no rain because they have sinned against you, and they pray in this place, confess your name and turn from their sin when you afflict them, right? Then hear them and open up and allow rain. Verse 28, when there's famine in the land, and every time that there's this calamity, what's tied with it? Because they have sinned, right? So there's no rain, there's famine, and then he gets down to verse 32 and begins to talk about those who are foreigners. Also concerning the foreigner who is not from your people Israel, when he comes from a far country for your great name's sake, your mighty hand and your outstretched arm, when they come and pray toward this house, then hear from heaven, your dwelling place, and do according to all for which the foreigner calls to you, in order that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel, that they may know that this house which I have built is called by your name. So why does Solomon ask that God listen to the prayer of the foreigner or to the cry of the foreigner? It's so that all can know that he is God and that they can all fear you. And in verse 34, one of the last ones, it says specifically, when your people go out into battle against your enemy by whatever way you shall send them, and they pray to you toward the city which you have chosen and the house which I have built for your name, then hear from heaven their prayer and their supplication. 36, when they sin against you, there is no man who does not sin, and you are angry with them and deliver them to an enemy, so that they take them away captive to a land far off or near. If they take thought in the land where they are taken captive, and repent and make supplication to you in the land of their captivity, saying, we have sinned, we have committed iniquity, and have acted wickedly. Does that occur? Yes, most certainly. Sadly enough, all of these things occur, right? If at this point was Solomon, but what do we see in the history? It happened. Right? And so they can look back and they can think about at this point, I would say a high point for Israel, right? They have wealth. They have a very wise king, right? They have peace. Their borders at this point are the largest that they have been and actually will ever be. Yet sometimes I think just like what happens to us, right? What happens to us when things are going the best at times? That's right. We get complacent. Do we not think sometimes that we have done this on our own? And we forget where this really comes from? And I would say that, you know, it's easy for us to flip through a few chapters in the Bible and pass 60, 70, 100 years, right? But you see generations going by where, just like today, you may have a very strong and a very, you know, deeply thoughtful generation of Christians, those who follow God, yet that next generation comes along and they just always knew that everybody was going to take care of what needed to be taken care of, and they maybe didn't learn as much as they should have. And so you have this weakness. And if we take it out of the spiritual, right, look at what's happening in our society. Right? This is what happens when nations fall. Right? Because the voice, I think I hear this a lot, right? Why is the voice of the few so much more important than the voice of the many? Right? Because all of a sudden that is equated to freedom. Because we have to be free to only allow a small percentage of people to do whatever it is that they want to do. We can't say anything about that because that's not freedom anymore. And so when evil or when sin takes over and becomes what has to be the commonplace, you know, did that not happen in Rome before it fell? I mean, we can look at history and see that these societies that went in out of control and did whatever it is that they wanted to do, however it is that they wanted to do it, then what happens? Right? They fell. So, something that we have to guard against ourselves. But here, I think Israel is very strong. They're excited about the fact that this wonderful structure has been built. And they're proud of this. Right? They're so proud of this. We see this later when the temple is recreated. It talks about some of the older Israelites were almost sad because they knew that that new structure, that new temple that was built, didn't even touch the glory of this one. Right? And so, something that they could really be proud of. They have all these things, and everything is going for them. In verse 40 through 42 of chapter 6, when Solomon ends his prayer, he says, "Now, O my God, I pray, let your eyes be open and your ears attentive to the prayer offered in this place. Now, therefore, arise, O God, to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. Let your priest, O Lord God, be clothed with salvation, and let your godly ones rejoice in what is good. O Lord God, do not turn away your face, the face of your anointed. Remember your loving kindness to your servant David." So, now, he completes that prayer, and then what occurs? Right. Fire from heaven comes down and consumes, consumes the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the house. Okay? Filled the house. So, the priest couldn't go back into the temple at this point, and that visual effect of the fire coming down and consuming all of this, what does that do if you're an Israelite that's standing there and you just heard Solomon's prayer? Right. That's right. So you see that it's a physical confirmation, right? You see the reaction of God to Solomon and his prayer, and the acceptance as it comes down and it burns, as it burns these offerings to the Lord. Now, then we see Israel's reaction to it. I think also a reaction that we can read about in Leviticus, the 9th chapter, but in verses 1 through 3, specifically 3, chapter 7, verse 3. "All the sons of Israel, seeing the fire come down and the glory of the Lord upon the house, bowed down on the pavement with their faces to the ground. And they worshipped and gave praise to the Lord, saying, truly he is good, truly his loving kindness is everlasting." What's happening in Leviticus, the 9th chapter? Verses 23 and 24. So Leviticus, the 9th chapter, the priest, right? The priest have just gotten everything that they have consecrated. Then they begin to start with the offerings. And in 23 and 24, it says, "Moses and Aaron went to the tent of meeting. When they came out and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of the fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces." So same thing occurred whenever the tent of meeting was being dedicated the first time as well. And this allows these people to realize that as they said, truly he is good, truly his loving kindness is everlasting. So, that's right. And in this case, as you were saying, Rain, they had a physical structure that was where God dwelt, right? But today, God dwells within us. And you're right. As we go to God in prayer, it's just like they had gone to God in front of the altar and they offered, right? And we have to live that every day. It's a very important parallel that we have to remember, and one that, and I'm moving again. One that we have to remember. So we continue here with, we see even more sacrifices were offered, I'm sorry. And it specifically tells us what Solomon was, had offered. It was 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. Alright. Is that better? So, the king and all the people dedicated this to the house of God. Now, there was so much that was being offered. All of this would not fit on the altar. Okay. Remember how big the altar was? It was 30 feet by 30 feet. Right? This is a massive altar, but there was so much that was being offered on this day that a portion of the middle, court, was allocated just to burn the burnt offering and the fat of the peace offering. So we see that so much is being done. The court is being, used for this. And also this would be another reason why it would have taken all of the priests to participate because, of the amount of offering that was taking place. I do remember at one point in one of the classes, not something I have written down here, just myself having never really seen a lot of animals slaughtered, but others that talk about that, the amount of blood and the amount of just, massive amounts of, I guess you'd say dirtiness, right? That occurs just on killing an animal or two, and to imagine 22,000 oxen or cattle and 120,000 sheep being slaughtered in one place over a short amount of time. I think they said that references to blood just basically running down all over the ground, and it would have to. And it's a lot of animals that are being done, and it's a very, I guess, visually stimulating event that would take place if you saw that many animals being sacrificed. And yet, all of that is now, is now done away with because of the blood of Christ. So, I think an important point. So next we move on to specifically this feast of dedication in verses 8 through 10. It talks about that, that they observed this feast for 7 days, and about the 23rd day of the month, the people returned to their homes. They were called and they came to the city, for the feast, it said, of the seventh month. What's the feast of the seventh month? Do we remember that? So in the seventh month was the Day of Atonement on the 10th day. So they would probably have been there around the 10th day for the Day of Atonement. Remember the Day of Atonement and what that is? The once a year that the priest could actually enter into the Holy of Holy Places and atone for all the sins of the year. So they entered in there, and then the Feast of Booths, also the Feast of the Tabernacles called, that began on the 15th of the month. And so during this time was this dedication feast, and we see in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verses 11 through 16. I've read 11, I think, last week, talking about Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up, but didn't put her in the house, didn't put her in the city of David until she had a house built because the places are holy where the Ark of the Lord is entered. So she is staying somewhere else at this point. After Solomon finishes the house, she is brought into the city of David, into Jerusalem. But in verse 12, it says, "Then Solomon offered burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar of the Lord, which he had built before the porch, and did so according to the daily rule, offering them up according to the commandments of Moses for the Sabbaths, the new moons, and the three annual feasts, Feast of the Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. Now according to the ordinance of his father David, he appointed the divisions of the priests for their service and the Levites for their duties of praise and ministering before the priests according to the daily rule, and the gatekeepers by their divisions at every gate. For David, the man of God, had so commanded. And they did not depart from the commandment of the king to the priests and Levites in any manner or concerning the storehouses. Thus all the work of Solomon was carried out from the day of the foundation of the house of the Lord until it was finished, and so the house of the Lord was complete. So he continues to offer the daily sacrifices, the sacrifices annually that they should have, and that happens from the time he started the temple building all the way through now, and it continues on. So we see this, the heart of Solomon at this point is very much making sure that he's doing what he should and the things that David had asked him to do. All right. Any questions about the dedication of the, that winds up really the dedication of the temple? I agree. Certainly the top of their, I guess of their lives spiritually and physically at this point, but we will see just in the next week or so the downfall of what happens once Solomon, turns away and then changes, passes away, and then what happens next, and that gets into the next quarter, but a lot of things change between now and when the kingdom divides. And, I like your reference, when Jesus, talks about even Solomon in all of his glory, right? Well, there's not a raid like the lilies of the field. Right? That the beauty here and everything that they would have seen and thought were the greatest things ever, right, were still not like all these little things that we see in nature. Now. I agree. And just to recap, because I know anybody watching online couldn't hear that, but also some in here might not have been able to hear that the dedication here is about that the one small thing that they would have been able to say that they have done for God after hearing this prayer and all that God had done for them. I think a very, very key point that you brought up. So quickly, we also have some verses, specifically, 2 Chronicles 9, 17 through 19, and 1 Kings 10, 18 through 20, that tell us about kind of the rest of Solomon's house, his palace, the house of the force of Lebanon. This is a sketch of what they think it may have been, how it may have been laid out. And you see the daughter of Pharaoh and her house that are right off the palace. So, all right. I actually did have a couple of thoughts. We kind of covered them as we went through, though. But, you know, why did God accept the temple? We talked about the fact that it was built to the pattern, right? God accepted it because it was built to the pattern. And then Solomon's prayer asked God to forgive or relent based upon what? Every time he went through the prayer, he said, you know, please forgive them. But why was he asking them to be forgiven? Right. Because they repented, right? There was an action that was required on their part in order to get the forgiveness that he's been asked to give. So, anyway, thank you for your attention and your comments. I will not be here next week.